Welcome back to the Andrew Hines Real Estate Investing Podcast. This is a midweek episode, but a little different. I have a guest today because I've been saying I wanted guest feedback or I wanted audience feedback, and Dan listens to the podcast. So stay tuned. Dan's episode is coming up this weekend, but this is the midweek episode. And Dan Illes, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Does this formally make me a co-host or?
Yeah, sure. Because this is just banter. We're not too serious on this. So, you know, the purpose of these midweek episodes for those who are still new to this is just kind of going over like things I think about, what I'm working on, and my thoughts about the markets, what's happening. And there's been a lot going on lately. You might have some insights on things you want to talk about, but I'll just give a quick recap. So I'm doing stuff in Florida right now. We keep hiring acquisitions managers into our business down there because we're doing all these cold call off-market leads. And we had a guy come onto our team yesterday. Wouldn't you know it, the first morning he ties up a deal.
Oh, wow.
He finds a deal. He's just calling leads because we had hundreds of leads that had not been connected with because we just got so many leads and our guys couldn't keep up. So he comes in and he quit his job. He went full time on this.
Oh, wow.
He's like, I'm committed. This is my job now. First morning, ties up a deal. Today's his second day. He just sent another offer. He got it verbally accepted. So if he gets it, he'll be two deals in 2 days for a new guy.
Can I ask what kind of properties these are? Is this land or houses? These are
foreclosures, pre-foreclosures. So we have one list of pre-foreclosures and two lists for land leads.
And then what's the plan with some of these recent acquisitions?
Everything is a flip.
Okay.
So we'll do. So I was talking to you on the episode, which is coming out this weekend, about how we see a lot of land that has subdivide potential.
Mm-hmm.
And those who haven't seen Dan's episode yet, he's the subdivide guy. He can do that stuff. So I might pick his brain on that. But yeah, where we see opportunity, we'll do that stuff too. But early on, we just want quick, you know, we want to get dollars in the door. And then as we get a little further along with it, we'll keep bringing in experts such as yourselves who can help us nail down our subdivide strategy and make it work for us.
Very good.
But there's 67 or 68 counties in Florida, and each has their own policy on it. So there's a
are you concentrating on one specific area of Florida?
For the houses, we're doing... basically we started at the southern point and then we just worked our way up the coasts. And so for the pre-foreclosures list, we made it up to Tampa, but not St. Pete's on the west side. And then on the east side, we probably made it up to just north of Fort Lauderdale.
Okay. So you're looking at stuff in like Bradenton and I believe Sarasota.
Yeah. So we selectively removed a couple. I'll have to go back and this is going to be painful to figure out exactly which counties I put in before. But yeah, we went after specifically pre-foreclosure, and what we realized about our data is it wasn't perfect. Like there were a plenty in there. It was like an overdue HOA fee or a condo fee for those who don't know what that means. And they already squared it up. They're no longer in financial distress. And they're like, yeah, well, I want top dollar. So we had a lot of tire kickers, but plenty of people on that list, they just don't want to answer their phone because everybody's lighting up their phone.
And that was going to be a question. Yeah. I was going to ask you is the competition down there from everything I hear, see, and read.
It's intense.
It's pretty intense. And the one thing you and I talked about on our episode is how readily available data is. Yeah. What has been your thoughts on kind of the level of competition, the aggression, and how to deal with that?
Yeah, like, I do find that the competition is intense. Like on the land, some of the people will call. They'll be like, I had like four other people call and threw out offers. But if you know how you'll respond to that, well, hey, yeah, where are those offers right now? What happened with those? Oh, so it was just talk. You know what I mean? Like, yep. So you can kind of come back and chirp back at them a little bit when they say stuff like that. Yes, the competition's there. A lot of these landowners who don't even have like great land, they just think that they have like the best things in sliced bread because they've gotten all these literally blind offers. People just take a list and they mail merge it and they send them a blind offer on a price per acre. They don't even know. They took an online course and they started sending mail. Then you have the cold callers. So it gives the seller the impression that their land is worth a lot and they need to be brought back to earth. So it's nothing you can't overcome if you build it into your scripts. And a lot of what we're doing is we're trying stuff. We're listening to the phone calls and we're saying, okay, that's not working. We need to adjust our script and we need to add in language like this to get them to understand. Oh, okay. Yeah. Like you're different. You have good funding. Like we'll tell them, hey, yeah, I can appreciate a lot of people would say stuff like that. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people took an online course and they're just tying up your property and they're going to go try and sell it to somebody else before they close. You know, we're actually intending on closing on your lot. Like we have, you know, our founders are both, you know, fairly influential. We can raise money, all that stuff. So we have our angle. And I think you just really got to lean into it. Like you got to be able to confidently tell people why they should work with you, which we're slowly figuring it out. It's like been a month and a half that we've been doing this, and our systems and everything we're doing is just really starting to click. We had one deal we tied up that fell apart and it was like kind of heartbreaking. And we've since been tying up. We've been sending out a lot of offers. Like we're focusing on the KPIs, right? Like what are your KPIs? What is it that drives your business forward and makes you profit? And making offers is exactly that. Making offers, putting it on paper and getting it in front of sellers.
Up here, I don't know of anybody that's sending out blind offers. It's not something that comes up very much.
Well, how could you though? Because you can't easily find the information like you can down there.
It's tough. It just feels like you'd have to spend hours.
If you spent we're talking hundreds of hours, but you would be rewarded so handsomely for your hundreds of hours of work. If you were to go to the county tax roll or the city tax roll and just start getting all the different owner names and their parcel identification or their tax roll IDs.
Yep.
And then you look up those lots, figure out how big they are. You could pay VAs to do this. You would invest in it. But once you had that list built, you could just hammer them with mail. I mean, it'd be great if you could skip trace them in Canada like you can in the US. You can find their phone numbers and all that. And then you just pay a call center that runs out of Philippines or wherever and have them call them.
I'll give you a story on that. So I did spend some time finding pieces of land here in Southern Ontario that I believe would have some high development potential. And I kind of did that through using a GIS software, so digital mapping software to identify parcels. And yeah, it takes some time and effort to find somebody's name and phone number and that kind of stuff. But what I do find though, is when you approach somebody, they haven't been approached like maybe a landowner in the US has. And when you send somebody a piece of mail and you've put their names on it and you've specifically titled it to them, the response rate isn't bad. And I'll give you an example. We sent out about just 80 letters just to some landowners here in Ontario. We actually got 4 leads from that, a bunch of callbacks, and went and saw some property. And 80 in the grand scheme of things is not very much.
Like early on in Florida, like I hear stories of people talking about getting a 1% response rate on blind offers at anywhere from 40 to 50 cents on the dollar on what they think market value is, like, and people would sign them and send them back. So if you were to do that here and say you got 1% because these people have never been hit that way, I mean, how many deals are you going to get? I mean, they're just people who are sitting on land that's been a long time. They don't use it. They don't need it. Doesn't owe them anything. And you're going to offer them $100,000 when it's worth 200 or 250. They're like, wow, $100,000. All right. Yeah, sure. All yours.
Sure. I could see that specifically working in kind of the vacation markets, the Great Lakes markets, where people have just had a piece of land sitting in the family forever with aspirations to one day build something.
Yeah.
Never ends up happening. And that's the kind of stuff you might be able to scoop up doing stuff like that.
Right. If you send them a letter that says, I'll pay you this much and we'll close in 30 days. And here's the offer. All you have to do is sign here. And then when it comes back, we sign it. Yeah. And then you're done. And I think the simplicity, sometimes some people just wins. Hey, I could really use that money right now. I don't care. Like I could call a realtor. I could go through all that. Or I could just take this what's in front of me right now. I'll just do it.
If they've been sitting on it long enough too.
And no one's been blowing up their phone. No. Like they haven't been getting head up about it. And you're the one guy that came out of the woodworks. In their perception, not everybody's interested in. Just this one guy is willing to pay him.
I think too, if they've been sitting on it long enough, they probably did not pay very much for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then when you come in with an offer that might seem low by today's standards,
they don't know
it can
that.
It can still be 8 times what they paid for it.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah, exactly. 8 times what they paid for it. But down in the States, like we'll go after some of the bigger land because it's hard for them to comp it. Like it takes us a while because like sometimes it's just really hard to find a comp for a 250 acre parcel. So here, how are they going to comp it? Like, how are they going to tell what it's worth? They'd have to call a realtor they know. What if they don't know a realtor? You know, so I think the opportunity is insane if you were to put the time into it. It's just, it would be probably fairly expensive, like several thousand, probably $5,000 in paying a VA to compile a list.
Another question I'd have for you is, so when we talk about land up here in Ontario, due diligence is kind of, it's fairly straightforward. We know there's zoning that has to be looked into and the size of the property and infrastructure and river conservation authorities. Mm-hmm. It's something you kind of get better at over time as you go through these processes. But you're talking about doing stuff in Florida, and there's going to be aspects of land or development that just do not apply here. Like, for example, they don't even bury their water mains in some locations because it doesn't freeze. There's different kinds of environmental challenges there that aren't up here. And even just listening to you personally speak, you've talked about having vacant lots sitting low versus the road and some of the challenges that come with that. So how do you learn about, like, how to do due diligence in somewhere very, very kind of foreign to us?
You know what? I was just like, I was a guy that watched a bunch of videos. Like, I obviously did. And then it's like playing around with the tools. So there's something called Land ID in the US that you can use, and you can map out any parcel. You can overlay the floodplain. You can overlay the wetlands, and you can get a pretty darn good idea of what you can do there. And I don't overcomplicate it. The way I keep it easy is if I see stuff in the same neighborhood, you know, reasonable comparables selling, I know that it's not my problem to figure out how you would develop it. I just know that people place a certain value on it.
Yep.
So then I'm getting it at 50 cents. So I'm not going down that rabbit hole too much. I'm trying to resist my over analytical side and just look at it. Hey, I have comps that are very similar properties to this in the same area that are selling for this. If I offer 50 cents, I'm going to be okay there. But yes, I do. The big things I watch out for are landlocked properties. So if I don't have direct access, that's a problem. I pretty much universally just say no to those. Wetlands, you're not allowed to build on wetlands in Florida, but there are certain circumstances where people can find a loophole. But even still, they still have a value for like cattle grazing and quadding and doing this and that. Like, they still have a value. It's just like, what is that value? And I made this mistake. I had this property tied up for $7,500, and it was a learning experience. But I assigned it to a guy who wouldn't, he had the partner thing. He had a partner offer. I asked him to partner with me on it because I didn't know what I was doing. It was early. And he said, well, I can't partner. I don't really know what I'll do with it, but I could offer you $3,000 for an assignment. So he was in for 10, five, he sold it for 48. Wow. He just turned around, listed it, sold it for 48. So I learned my lesson there a little bit. That wetlands still do have a value. It was a 5-acre wetland for $7,500. It's hard to imagine how you lose. The thing about this, what was so great, it's just down the school from a residential like neighborhood, a public school. It was like right in an area where any lot that size was like $200,000. So the wetland factor was just this wild card. And the only solution I have for that stuff is, other than if I can't comp it, I can't buy it. Like, that's my hard and fast rule. Like, I'll buy wetlands, but I got to see another piece of wetland sell. I'll buy something that's landlocked, but I got to see another piece of landlocked sell. And if I don't, I'm not interested. Not interested now. Down the road, who knows? Like, as you have more references and more experience, like, you've probably seen it in your work. Like, you carry over something you experienced in one county and you use it in another. And you know, hey, based on what I did there, I know I can do this here. And now all of a sudden you're thinking in a way that others don't. And I can't wait till I get there. I can wait. It's all part of the experience. But you know, that's the part I'm working towards. I know I'm no expert now. Like, I'm just working through it. Working through what I don't yet know.
For sure. Have you worked with any U.S. investors specifically? Are you kind of learning this on your own or working with some other Canadian investors? Or
I like binge a lot of content right now. Yeah. I'm listening to a lot of different land podcasts, getting ideas. And then I have a couple of masterminds of people who are doing U.S. land that we pitch, you know, questions in a WhatsApp chat and share stuff. And that I find really valuable. Like, I'll find I get busy. They meet once a week and do like a Zoom session. And lately I've been missing it because we're working on deals. And I'm like, good reason to miss it. But when I catch it, I've had some incredibly insightful experiences there. And it's just like anything, right? Like, the more you do something, you just start to find little niches within that thing that other people aren't focused on. And now all of a sudden you have your angle.
Very good.
Which, I mean, I know you do, like a million ways over, which people who listen to the weekend episode will know.
For sure. So by no means are you flying blind then when it comes to any of this stuff, if you've got those kind of people in your corner. And I think even for myself, you were talking about like using all the tools at your disposal, whether it's like digital mapping or whatnot. I think for me personally, if I were to do this somewhere I was unfamiliar with and I saw a layer and I didn't know what it meant, I would find out what it meant, whether it was calling the city, talking to another developer. One thing I've personally thought about doing is trying to find somebody to work with that's doing similar work somewhere else, where I can take skills and just start helping and applying and learning the ropes as I go through. So that's definitely something I'm thinking about too.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, don't invent the wheel. I joke that I was a professional wheel inventor for a long time. And like I'll always lean on who's the expert, who can I find that could tell me that. I find the municipalities down there just kind of annoying to work with, and I've always found better luck walking in face to face. Leaning on other groups of investors, even if they're not investing exactly in the counties I'm in or the Florida, Florida as a state in general, I still pick up stuff. And as far as like the land, like the ID maps and stuff go, like we've actually like hedged our risk with our process. We do conditionally tied up, so we'll tie up for 30 days on a 30-day close, so the entire time it's conditional. And then as we're working through that, we're calling up a realtor, we're getting an opinion of value. So I'll call the realtor that sold the comp. If the one across the road sold, I'm calling that realtor and saying, hey, you sold the one across the road, how do you feel about selling this one? And who's not gonna say yes? It's not a hard sale to get the realtor in. And then they go out, they comp it. They say, hey, you know what? I'm pretty confident I can get this for it. It's only then we decide to close. If they say something we don't like, we're going back to the seller and saying no. So, the realtors who work those areas are experts in those properties. So I just keep it real simple. Big things I watch out for, of course, are wetlands. If I have to put a driveway through that wetland, it's probably going to be a deal breaker. I might still tie it up and get an opinion, but we're not going to take any risks with that kind of thing. We're only closing on stuff we know.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it's fun stuff. But one of the reasons I wanted to have you do this with me, since you were here already and I needed this episode, is you're actually a part of the audience, which I really appreciate. And you can give some feedback. So what do you think of the midweek episodes so far?
I've listened to most of them so far. Yeah. Part of it's because I'm on the road a fair little bit these days, overseeing some renovations. So I've got a little more, little more podcast time to be had, but I've been enjoying them. It's nice to hear kind of your opinion on some stuff, whether it be up here in Ontario or what you're doing in the States. Because a lot of these podcasts you conduct, it's you asking them questions, and it's great, but it's kind of nice to hear you take a minute and sit down and share your thoughts, because this market right now is like nothing a lot of us have seen either before or in recent years. So it's cool to have something current to listen to. I think current right now is a great way to go for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, these are super fresh. Like, I usually record them on Wednesday for release Thursday morning. Today it's Tuesday, so released on Thursday. So like really fresh. There was just new stuff that came out in the news we could talk about. Anything current events wise we should talk about?
The budget was coming out today. Yeah. Now I've been sitting here visiting with you, so I don't know what's in it yet.
There was another announcement though last week. Somebody had sent it to me and they're like, hey, you should talk about this. And I forget what it was. My editor was sending it to me. What did he send? Likely something Daniel Foch talked about.
Yep.
Let's see here. I'm trying to pull it up. Oh, yes. Yes, it was the widening gap between public, private, and self-employment. And it's this chart. You've probably seen it floating around. Yeah. Daniel Foch, I'm pretty sure, posted this. So in terms of like, employees or people working in the different sectors, self-employed has gone down 5 points since 2020. So all the people they put out of business when they did the lockdowns pretty much. And then public sector is like through the roof. So the trend line basically continued for public sector, but everything else is down. Private sector and not exactly where you want to be. What do you take on all that?
I did see the chart.
Do you want it back?
I'm good. I remember that one. I don't love seeing things like that. I think I know you're doing a lot of stuff in the US, and I like that spirit of entrepreneurship and building a business. And I don't like to see it go the other way, because I think the more you grow the public sector,
The more you have to grow the taxes.
The more you have to grow the taxes, and the more you're taxed, like realistically, kind of the less personal freedoms you have.
Yeah. And I mean, I think Canadians, a lot of them are at apathy as far as taxation goes, which is why a lot of incredibly wealthy ones are leaving. Again, I'm not saying flee. Like, I think you can make lots of money here, and you don't need to, like, you could still crush here, even though everybody else is like, I'm not really interested. Not everybody, but a lot of people. That kind of thing is like, it's very common with liberal governments. I remember speaking to people who lived in Ottawa, and they'd be like, well, depending on whether it's a liberal or a conservative government, like, they would kind of predict what was going to happen to rent prices. They're like, it's crazy how many people move into the city when it's a liberal government versus it shrinks. I don't know the numbers on that. But this makes sense for the liberal government. Would anything change on the conservative government? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not.
I don't get hung up too much these days about the names of the parties, because we've got liberal, conservative, and others, but we've got conservative governments that aren't conservative at all.
Yeah. And I don't think Pierre is any savior. I know, like, some people just love him. I don't really expect anything, because I think if you make it to that point where you lead a party, you have already kissed the rings. Like, you do not get to lead a political party unless you're willing to kiss the rings, whether it be people who sponsor that party or certain people who grease certain palms. They want somebody in their corner that's going to sort of be their crony politician. And I just don't see it being any different. And if it's not, say Pierre has entirely good intentions, give it some time.
My comment was even more a little directed at the province of Ontario,
because Doug is not conservative.
Not really. Running massive deficits and accumulating the largest sub-sovereign debt in the world, to my understanding, is not really a conservative thing to do.
No, not really. And then
there's other aspects of society, things like like some of the landlord tenant board challenges that we all face. You wouldn't really expect to see that in a truly conservative government. So no, I don't get too hung up on the titling of the parties these days.
Right. Yeah. And I my prediction with Ontario is that it's going to get to a point where it's like only institutions could really stomach it, in a large portion. Only institutions could really stomach being landlords. And then at that point, they're going to turn course on the landlord tenant laws, and it'll be heavy, heavy favoring the landlord. That's because the crony capitalist path. That's what I think. I don't know. I don't stress about these things. I just do business where I want to do business. I really don't think about politics at all anymore. I used to get really upset about all that crap. I just don't care.
I largely tune it out. I don't spend much time at all reading the news or anything. Every now and then, something will make it into my world. Yeah. But I definitely. I try to focus on what I'm doing, and I try to just
because I love the analytics that Dan Foch puts into his stuff, and I had him on the podcast, and it's like it's very very interesting to talk to him. It's just I can't put my head in that stuff. I got to focus on what I can do, and if I focus on all these stats and all the stuff that's happening in the economy, I'm not a victim of that.
Yeah, I've met Dan, a really nice guy, and actually I was happy to see that he was on your podcast. I thought it was like a super team episode or something like that, because you both have really, really good and notable podcasts. So
yeah, he's a good guy. I want to get him back on again. Hopefully we'll time something and get him on for an update. But anyways, Dan, I really appreciate you doing this, and you are back on the weekend, so you're getting a double feature here.
Wonderful.
All right, thanks, Chris.
Okay, thanks, Andrew.